Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, feel good about driving.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 339 for July 22nd of 2016. Back when Fiat did not want Chrysler. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, welcome, everybody, to another episode of Autoline After Hours. Gary Vasilash is not here today, regrettably. I think he's on vacation. Gary will be back on the show again in the future. But we got a great show today. Joining me right now from the journalist side of things is Daron Levine with SiriusXM Radio. Got your own station there.
And thestreet.com.
And thestreet.com. Yep. David Welch from Bloomberg is going to be joining us later today, too. He's stuck in traffic, and the traffic's terrible this afternoon.
Probably stuck in Bloomberg.
Could be, but he'll be joining us. But we also have Steve Miller, the chairman and CEO of the supplier company IAC. Steve, it's great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much.
We had you on the TV show a while back, talking all about things about IAC and what you're doing there. But you've got a tremendous amount of, I almost dare call it heritage in the industry right now. You were what, with the car companies, both Ford and Chrysler,
right? I started my career with Ford and then went with Iacocca to Chrysler during the bailout and recovery and merger with American Motors and all that. It was a very exciting time to be there.
People forget that when Iacocca went to Chrysler, he took a number of Ford people with him.
Yes, he did. And it was those who had an appetite for risk that went with him, because there was no guarantee you'd have a paycheck 30 days after you got there. But we all took that chance, and it worked out really well.
Well, talk about that. I find that fascinating, because Lee Iacocca and Henry Ford II had a blow-up, and Henry essentially or reportedly told him, "I just don't like you." And Iacocca was out. But Hal Spurlick, another great product planning guy at Ford, also had run into problems with Henry Ford II, and he had already gone to Chrysler. And I don't know if Hal played a role, but how did Iacocca end up at Chrysler?
Well, I do believe Hal played a role there, because he was kind of the advance guard, said it's okay, and told the board of directors at Chrysler that Iacocca was one heck of a talent, which he was, and it's certainly what Chrysler needed at that time.
Now, what led you to go, okay, Lee's going to Chrysler, I'm going too? You had a pretty good job at Ford.
Well, I actually had my advance guard, and that was Jerry Greenwald, who had been my boss at Ford in Venezuela. I was the CFO at Ford in Venezuela. Jerry went, and then about a month later, he gave me a call and said, "Hey, this is really exciting. Come on up." And so I said, "Okay." And there I am.
So I'm still coming back to this. It was the challenge, the excitement of going to Chrysler that made you want to go there?
Absolutely. Just that this was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime kind of an opportunity.
Because Chrysler was in deep trouble at the time.
Totally deep trouble. I mean, I remember the cover of Newsweek magazine. It showed a picture of a Chrysler cartoon drawing with the thermometer in its mouth and bandages all over it. And the headline was...
And a mortician waiting outside the front door.
But it was, you know, "Can Chrysler Survive?" was the headline. So it was, you know, famously at death's door, and ultimately depended on getting loan guarantees from the government, which was not their usual government behavior at the time. Nobody had ever gotten such a thing. It became a huge controversy, of course, as to what's the role of our government in the private sector when somebody gets in trouble? Shouldn't you just let them go under? After all, there'd been hundreds of car companies over the preceding 75 years that had gone under. And, you know, why not one more? But the impact on employment, the impact on our economy at a time when the economy was kind of struggling anyway,
Sure, this is the time of the second oil crisis, the Iranian oil crisis, and all that going on.
It could have been a very serious blow. I mean, the estimates were that the demise of Chrysler might take 500,000 jobs down with it. And that's what motivated the Congress to finally get behind it. And Iacocca did a great job. He and I had talked to Tip O'Neill, who convinced him that all... Speaker of the House. All politics are local. And therefore, we wrote to every congressman and said, here's how many jobs in your community, dealerships, suppliers, factories, if we had them there, here's how many jobs in your community depend on Chrysler. You know. And the other thing we had was, even though we had a lot of the big V8 rear-wheel drive engine cars that were gas guzzlers at the time, we had on our drawing boards the famous K car, front-wheel drive, fuel-efficient vehicle. And we sent every congressman a picture of the, you know, what became the Plymouth Reliant and Dodge
Aries,
and said, you know, we got these, we have 400,000 of a year production of these high mileage, pretty cars, if you vote yes. And so we eventually prevailed in that, still had a big battle to meet all the requirements of the law. It took 9 more months to negotiate with the banks and with suppliers and dealers, because...
And you were kind of the point guy on doing all that.
Yeah, I was running these, you know, this really multi-front negotiation. The whole point of Congress said, all right, we will put the taxpayers at risk, but only if all the stakeholders of Chrysler, including executives taking pay cuts, union accepting a pay freeze, you know, suppliers and dealers buying bonds in the company, and so on. Everybody had to contribute. And so the government money was used as the motivator, the magnet to attract all of that support from the whole community that depended on it. It was actually a great, you know, act of government, I think.
Hey, David Welch is here. Put a microphone on so people can hear you. But good to have you join us. I'm assuming you're stuck in traffic out there?
Traffic and stuck with Tesla.
Oh, Tesla. Okay.
Yeah, I told you. Yeah. That's right. They said you're stuck in traffic. I said you're stuck in Bloomberg.
A little both. Well, it's the 76 bit of a parking lot these days.
Yeah. There was a wreck out there. I hit the same thing. I don't know if they
cleared it up. Oh, it was a wreck? Yeah, it was. But I took an alternate route. I never saw what the problem was.
Yeah. Hey, one other thing I wanted to ask you about on the Chrysler days is a lot of people don't know this story, but... When you were at Chrysler, you guys tried to buy Fiat in, I want to say, 1991. In fact, I think you even started selling Alfa Romeos. Oh, you tell it, because you know it far better than I do.
You've got the players right, but actually, I tried to sell Chrysler to Fiat. It was at a time around 1990. We had a lot of discussions with Fiat about merging the two companies. The cost of goods... We saw all kinds of savings in the procurement side from the, you know, doubling the volume, if you will, of your global purchase. We had all the management organization things. We planned to put the headquarters in London, which, you know, eventually did happen, of course. But then one day the patriarch of Fiat came to New York and met with me and Iacocca.
You're talking about Johnny Agnelli?
Johnny Agnelli. And said... this all looks good, but I can't proceed because the social liabilities, meaning the pensions and health care and all of that...
At Chrysler
are so frightening it could take not only Chrysler down, but Fiat down with it. And I cannot expose Fiat to that financial risk. And this was a deal, mind you, where we were going to sell Chrysler to Fiat for $2 billion... at a time when we had $2 billion of cash on the balance sheet.
So it would be free.
So it would be free if he would accept the liabilities.
Just taking it off your hands, basically.
Yeah, and he wouldn't do it. You know, 5 years later, Daimler comes along and spends $35 billion for the same property, And then they realize, oh, my God, there are some liabilities here.
So it turns out he was right.
Turns out John Agnelli was totally right. And then the ultimate story is life goes on. Chrysler goes through the what some would call the cleansing act of a bankruptcy. And Chrysler's or Fiat is there to then acquire the company, you know, without that huge liability load. And they're a very successful combination today, you know, headquartered in London. Way to go.
Was this the episode with Bob Woods' dead bride comment? Was that part of that whole saga?
I'm trying to remember that one, but go ahead.
I thought it was one of the Fiat, you know, various Fiat Chrysler flirtations where he said, you know, something to the effect of nobody would want a dead bride or something like that. And it may have been earlier on because...
Well, that was the one time where we were seriously talking with Fiat. It was 1990-ish. And, you know, we were struggling at the time, as we always do when the market...
So was that your task, Steve, go out and sell the company?
Well, it's something I worked feverishly on for quite some time, and we just about had it until Giovanni Agnelli said...
did his due diligence.
Yeah, and, you know, and again, I'm just totally amazed that then Daimler comes along and spends $35 billion at a moment in time when Chrysler was on a good roll with products that Bob Lutz had brought out.
The Ram, the Jeeps.
Yeah.
It was printing money.
Kind of like today.
Yeah. But guess what? The auto business is cyclical.
Yeah. What do you make of FCA today in the sense, like you say, it's cyclical. And right now, they're backing away from passenger cars really fast.
Well, back in my day when I was vice chairman at Chrysler, I did write a memo that said, you know what? We just can't ever seem to make a net profit on cars. We're making all of our money on Jeeps, minivans, and pickup trucks. So why don't we just do that? And somehow the memo got lost. And now that I'm a supplier and I care deeply about supplying interiors to the cars that they're building, they write me a letter to say, hey, we're going to stop making them. So I'm really offended that it took this long for the memo to get through the system.
Do you think that'll work, though? Like you say, it's cyclical. Right now, trucks, Jeeps, Rams, you know, 4x4s, all that selling great. Gas is cheap, oil's cheap, but it's cyclical.
Here's the theory is that you can't just cherry pick what vehicles you want to make. You have a dealer body out there, and if you don't give them the complete range of cars and trucks, small cars, big cars, cheap cars, luxury cars, and all the whole range of things that we register as trucks, that your dealers are going to find a way to sell them. And if they don't have anything coming out of your factories, they will stick another brand in their store, and then you will lose some of the loyalty of that dealer body. That, you know, sometimes you need them when times are tough. You know, they kind of depend on you because you're the sole source for them. And if instead you allow them to put another brand in the store, you've lost control of your retail network. Hmm. So that's the argument, even though the economics might say you're better off to be specialized. Just make the good stuff.
Well, Chrysler has really, Fiat Chrysler has gotten around that because most of their dealers carry all their brands. So, for instance, the Dodge Ram pickup truck used to be a Dodge. Now it's just Ram. And if you have a Jeep store, you probably have Dodge and Chrysler and everything with it. So you're taking all their products. I think that they're also finding that they've got a lot of brands given the fact that they're selling 4+ million vehicles a year worldwide, and it's a lot to keep all those brands alive. So they've got to somehow figure out a way to shrink down the number of brands they've got. They're trying to fund Maserati. They're trying to fund Alfa Romeo. They're trying to fund Jeep. They're trying to fund Dodge, Chrysler. It's actually a lot when you look at, in comparison, a company like Toyota that has what?
Two.
Lexus
Two
and brands. Toyota.
Right.
I mean, that's it.
Well, they have a little bit more than that.
Right.
But you're right. It makes it a whole lot easier to care and feed a couple of brands versus a couple of handfuls.
Totally. Yeah.
Well, Steve, wasn't the other issue with going down to just what Chrysler's good at, which is SUVs, Jeeps, minivans, Ram? The other issue historically was CAFE. You had to meet fuel economy requirements, and the way you did that was small cars, even if you had to force feed them to consumers with incentives into rental fleets. But now the CAFE is footprint-based. You still do have to, I think, hit an overall number, but isn't it a lot easier now to just sell what you're good at as opposed to having to sell everything? I mean, it is sort of outrageous if you think about it that there's a government regulation that makes you sell everything, no matter how bad you are at building it and selling it.
I wish that was the worst government regulation. there's worse than that.
Even though it's politically unpopular, I think the right way to manage fuel economy is to have taxes on fuel. It's the simplest, quickest, slickest way to motivate your buyers. I mean, Europe doesn't have a CAFE requirement, but they sell a lot of very elegant small cars. Why? Because
$7 a gallon.
At $7 a gallon, you take that into consideration. So we have these competing things of trying to keep the fuel price low in the U.S., but force the manufacturer to devote a lot of production capacity to small cars. And so you're at war with your customer.
But isn't that different?
That's right.
Now?
The consumer does not want customers. And Bob Lutz very famously said, it's like trying to make people lose weight by mandating that you're going to make clothes in only small sizes. It doesn't work.
And you guys are completely right, and we're never going to get a fuel tax a high fuel tax. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. It's the third rail of American politics.
I know.
Is that what enabled Fiat Chrysler to back away from small and mid-sized cars?
David, it changed.
I'm not sure what happens when they just get out of making cars altogether. Because the regulation, you know, way going way back to the start, had one regulation for cars and another regulation for trucks, which was pickup trucks, and at that time a lot of them were for commercial use and so on. So the government bifurcated the standard. They never regulated how many cars versus trucks you could make, so you did not have a fleet average, but you had a car average that you had to observe.
Right.
Well, if you just say, I'm not making any cars, then you're not in violation of the standard.
And today you can do that. Yeah. But that's since 2012, I want to say, when they changed the law. So, yeah, before
earlier than that, actually.
Well, it might have been, but I think it became law in 2012, or it started being implemented then. And you're right. Now it's based on the footprint. And
Here's a little thing. When at Chrysler in 1984, we brought out the minivan. Okay, what's a minivan? Is that a car or is it a truck?
It's a truck.
That was a real question for us because it mattered on meeting the fuel economy requirements. So the first production of minivans, we just decided to make 15% of those minivans without the side glass so that they would be panel trucks. And therefore, we registered the entire line of minivans as a truck, which meant it had a much easier hurdle on fuel economy.
Because they were more efficient than all the other trucks
and
you were selling.
And some other things, they didn't have to have headrests and things like that. But my point is, we're producing
vehicles that nobody really wanted or needed. And most commercial applications want a beefier vehicle than the minivan, which is basically a K-car, okay? But we did it in order to try and satisfy the regulators that this was a truck, and we made a few cars off of that. Well, after a year, we finally had established that this was a truck for gas mileage regulatory purposes, and then stopped making the panel van version.
But wait, nothing's really changed, right? No. We have to make electric cars today in order to satisfy regulations for emissions-free driving, but clearly the consumer en masse, other than a few hundred thousand people, don't want electric cars, but we're going to force feed them onto it.
I mean, if you subsidize it enough, you can create some demand. And the total amount of government subsidies going into electric cars today is, putting aside the regulatory impact of you have to make so many in your mix for fuel economy reasons. The fact is, the subsidies to the factories that make them, the subsidies to the customers that buy them, makes it something where nobody knows where the real economic balance point is for electric cars.
Hey, quick break here. We got to take a quick commercial break. We got to give a shout out to our friends at BorgWarner. And Carmen, why don't we do that right now? So I'm also curious, going back to your Chrysler days there, towards the end, there was kind of a revolt against Iacocca, wasn't there? I mean, it seems to me that there were people like you, certainly Jerry Greenwald. I got to believe that Jerry Greenwald held ambitions to become CEO of Chrysler. And I think you all got the idea at some point, Lee's going to leave when they peel his cold, dead fingers off this company.
Well, that I think certainly in the case of Greenwald, he thought that once we got stabilized in the mid-'80s that Lee would hand over the reins. And then once we were successful and Lee was becoming more and more famous, Lee kind of liked the job. And so he wasn't going to leave anytime soon. And so when, remember, United Airlines came along and gave Jerry a big bonus for packing up and leaving to go try and run the employee buyout at United. So we lost Jerry in that round. The concerns I had in the last years that Iacocca was in charge were, one, we were pursuing market share more than we were pursuing profitability. I'm a finance guy, so that wasn't working for me. And by volume and market share, it was we were pumping cars through the rental car fleets like crazy, where we'd have, 60 days, and then we'll buy it back. And then
60 days.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so everybody was doing that, too. So, GM and Ford were doing it. Well, everybody was all doing Detroit.
Competing because that was the easiest way to get your registrations up. But what it meant is your dealers pretty quickly caught on to it. And so they would be able to, for $5,000 cheaper, sell you a nearly new car. And that was kind of eating the lunch out of the volume potential for the new cars. So that was a problem in itself.
And if you were one of these poor dopes as the consumer who happened to buy this car, you would find that the resale value of your car just basically disappeared as soon as you bought it.
Yeah. And so Lutz was the one who said, we're now in the business of manufacturing used cars.
I remember that. That's a good line.
I actually wrote a story back then for the New York Times under the headline, The Almost New Car.
So that was one issue I had with Lee, and it was kind of the most fundamental issue. We also were, spending money on things I didn't think made much sense. Another question at the time was, would you rather sell 10,000 small cars with a variable margin of 1,000 or sell 1,000, Grand Wagoneers or something very large, high profit SUV with a margin of 10,000. And you would say, well, aren't they about the same one or the other? And the answer is, yeah, but the one, the higher margin car takes up a lot less, capital and everything else to get it done. But so this pursuit of just market share at the expense of return on capital, was a sticking point with us.
But so there was a very strong management team at Chrysler at the time. You guys must have been talking amongst yourselves, you and Lutz and the rest of them, going, what are we going to do about Lee?
Well, I think there was less of that than you might think. But, the now ancient history is that, the board was seriously considering, what are we going to do when Lee steps down? He's a unique character. He was responsible for saving the company. We wouldn't have anything to talk about if he hadn't done that. But at some point, we need to find successor management. And the bit of the politics there, Lee wasn't so sure he wanted either me or Lutz to replace him. And I think he also envisioned it would be nice to spend a few years as chairman, even if somebody else had the title of CEO, so he could stick around and help keep a hand on the tiller and make sure we didn't do anything crazy.
And make a lot of money.
Yeah, well, and keep access to the jet.
Right.
Keep access to the podium and all the accoutrements of being a senior leader. So that's where, and that, of course, started some internal politics, but Lutz and I said to the board, we don't care what titles you give the two of us. We are a team. Bob makes cars and I keep score, and we'll work it out just fine, however it works out. So
What was Lee's issue with you? I mean, the stories of Lee and Bob are pretty well known, but why wouldn't he have wanted you to run?
Watch your mic there, David. Just slid down because we want to hear what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I where I got crosswise with Lee wasn't over any of that, except the board, as part of this succession planning exercise, called five of us top guys in one-on-one to say, you know, if Lee retires, you know, what do you want the job, and how, what would you do different, and all that. And the one piece of advice I gave them was, you should not keep Lee around. He's CEO, he's great, but when the last day he's CEO should be the day that he leaves the board, doesn't become chairman, doesn't hang around. Let the next guy, you know, have a shot at running the company. However, he would think, if you ask me to do it, here's what I would do, and here are 10 points of difference with the current policies that we've got. But the main thing that stuck in his, he called me and he said, what did you tell the board? I said, well, I told them a bunch of things, including that you should not stick around. And he said, let me see this letter. And so he called me in. He took it home overnight, called me in the next day, and just beat the hell out of me, verbally. And he was kind of mad at me ever after that. And it wasn't long after that I got a call from a investment banking firm in New York to go do deals in New York. And I decided, you know what, that'll be a lot easier than trying to, you know, survive in the auto business.
Do you think that Iacocca had a problem with others who were working for him being able to replace him, and that he felt these people aren't good enough, that's why they work for me, we got to bring in somebody from the outside?
Yeah, well, I do believe that was a very much, you know, a part of it. He didn't want Lutz because he was afraid that, you know, Lutz would say unkind things about him in the aftermath of the changeover.
And he would have.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably would have.
And he probably would have. Yeah.
Although Bob was pretty complimentary of Iacocca in his book about leadership.
Now. I mean, years later, not at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think Theron's right on that one, right? Hey, look, we got to take another quick break right here. Steve, stick around. We got a lot more to talk about with you, but now we've got to give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back with Steve Miller. David, you were going to ask something?
So Chrysler ends up with Bob Eaton after Lee wasn't interested in having you or Bob Lutz run the company. How did that come to pass? Because a lot of people seal that. Basically, that sealed the fate of Chrysler being sold several times and you know, falling into the state that it did.
Well, first off, in the letter I wrote to the board as part of this, you know, their investigation of what the potential successors thought, I had written about other potential successors from outside. One of them was Roger Penske.
Wow.
And everyone's wanted to hire Roger. He's been too smart to take over a car company.
St. Roger, yeah. I didn't think much of him at the time, but I think in retrospect he'd have been a fabulous leader if he'd have taken it. I also said, I can't believe that the answer to Chrysler's problems could ever be found at GM. And how wrong was that? The board disagreed, and that was... there was an intermediary fellow who worked in finance named Fred Hubacher, who was friends of or neighbor of
Eaton's.
Of Bob Eaton's, and who kind of introduced that concept to Lee. And I think, you know, Lee wanted somebody who didn't have an internal axe to grind, if you will, and that's the way it went.
Wow. Very interesting how that all goes. Then, you know, just so the audience knows a little bit, you've been all over the place, too, since stepping out of the auto industry, though you're now back in it, too. You played a big role during the big collapse, as I call it, what other people call the Great Recession, in having to straighten out AIG, the big insurance company that had, what, insured all these credit default swaps, never imagining any of them would go bad, right?
Well, the big bet that, I mean, AIG was a great, and still is, a great insurance company. But they, at the holding company level, they had a division that speculated in home mortgages by providing guarantees on mortgage pools. And how much was that?
They insured the asset-backed securities.
Yeah, $2.3 trillion worth of guarantees. You know, and they just took a small, you know, few hundredths of a percentage point of commission every time they wrote one of these guarantees. And everybody said, oh, wow, if this is backstopped by AIG, terrific. Well, when the housing market crashed in 08, that undermined the whole credibility of AIG, and there was chaos. And that's the government. I mean, the government put in a bailout of over a weekend of $180 billion. Now, remember, back in my Chrysler days, I had fought tooth and nail for 9 months to get a $1 billion guarantee in place. AIG, $182 billion over a weekend. You know, times have changed. But in the aftermath of that, the government swept out the board of directors, wanted new blood on the board, people who had experience in dealing with tough times, and I was put on the board. I became the chairman of the board and was there until the middle of last year, 2015, as chairman. I'm still on the board, but I went in the aftermath of the crash at a time when the plan was liquidate the company, just break it up in little pieces and be done with it.
And they have sold some assets off. In fact, aren't they still selling a few things?
Yes, we have sold assets. We had a big aircraft leasing business. Right. We had a lot of peripheral businesses. But our core business is basically the property casualty business and the life and retirement businesses. Those are the two big nodes of our company that we'll be focused on going forward. And those are in, you know, in healthy condition. They're growing. There's huge in their own right, but we are now, you know, very, very focused, much more so than we ever were. So the company is fixed. I'm proud of that achievement. We paid back the government.
$182 billion?
Well, we got, you know, the whole $182 plus a $22 billion profit to the taxpayers. And in my recollection, there's only been two big controversial bailouts in history where the government got back not only their money, but a profit, and probably did a favor to the economy by doing the bailout itself. And that would be Chrysler and AIG. And I am proud to have been part of both of those.
Both. Pretty amazing. So how do you get the AIG job? Who calls you and says, Steve,
well, that was when the
we got a mess on our hands.
The government had hired headhunters. I mean, the government at that moment owned, I mean, not only had all these debts, but owned 93% of the stock, just like they had to take a big stock position at General Motors and so on to make it work in that bailout. So they now wanted a new board to kind of bring some fresh ideas and help with the recovery. And so it was the headhunter firm that called me and said, hey, Steve, have we got a job for you? And I had no idea going in what it was going to be like. I just thought it would be a great front row seat to this collision between our public and private sectors. I thought it'd be fascinating. I never expected it to be wildly successful.
That's amazing. So
who did you work with at the government? You didn't work with the auto task force. Was it Jim Milstein and the banking guys?
Milstein and of course Steve Ratner was the head of the auto task force, and Ron Bloom, who had been.
But did they deal with AIG as well?
No.
Okay.
Milstein was. Yes, absolutely. Milstein was right in the center of, from the Treasury's perspective.
So Jim Milstein's a restructuring guy. His father is Ira Milstein, who was the attorney for GM's board during the boardroom coup that ousted...
Perot.
No, Royce and...
Lloyd Royce
Stemple.
And Stemple.
He was also there and got rid of Ross Perot. Hmm. So yeah, he was kind of the gray eminence, the consigliere of the GM board,
yeah.
And is an expert in corporate governance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Steve, of course, today Wilbur Ross has tapped you to come in and say, "Hey, I've got this thing called IAC, this
yep.
International Automotive Components Company, but it's really interiors, right? Interior
that is right.
stuff."
Yep.
And so, what I wanted to ask you about is, we're on the verge of seeing autonomous cars, where it. And within our lifetimes, we're going to see the steering wheel, the gas pedal, the brake pedal, the gear shift, all that given the heave-ho. What's your vision? Where do you think interiors of cars are going with all this autonomy right around the corner?
Well, we're thinking about that a lot. I had a team go out to the Las Vegas, you know, Consumer Electronics Show, try and mix with the people who are thinking way into the future, and it may not be that far into the future where we start seeing this. But the implications for interiors, I remember, the interior of a car today is focused on comfort for the guy with the steering wheel in his hand who has to be focused on looking out the window. Now it's maybe more like a rolling living room. And that changes, you know, how you design the seats and what kind of comfort you want in there. But it also has got the possibility that a lot of people, if they're not focused on what's right ahead on the road and not concentrating on it, they would tend to get car sick, you know, from a vehicle that's weaving around. So
you have barf bags in the door pockets
could
now?
Could have barf bags, but we find that the smells within a car can influence your susceptibility to getting car sick. So we're, you know, it's more than just, you know, the touch and feel of the interior. The whole concept of how do you make people comfortable and not nauseous when they're kind of sitting back and reading or doing something else while the car is moving.
Have you built mock-ups? Are you doing?
I don't have mock-ups yet, but we're drawing them on paper and starting to think about it.
So maybe the interior of a car becomes more like a first-class cabin.
Yeah.
Kind of seating then designed around the ergonomics, focus, and safety and control of the driver.
Yeah. So I've been around the auto business for a long time, but I think the most exciting chapters are yet to be written.
I mean, totally agree with you. In fact, that leads to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, all this ride sharing and car sharing. Uber's off to the races. GM put $500 million into Lyft. But what I'm getting at, because it ties back to interiors, is, as you know, today the average car sits parked for 23 hours out of 24. But if you flip that around into car sharing and ride sharing, a car might be used 20 hours a day easily. And so instead of putting on, let's say, 12,000 miles a year, it could be putting on 80 to 100,000. So in 3 years' time, you're looking at cars having 250 to 300,000 miles on them. Nothing is designed for that, especially not the interior. Is that anything that you guys are giving thought to?
Well, the big roaring debate that I hear is whether this change is going to mean there's going to be more or fewer vehicles produced in a year. And if you figure that the life of a car doesn't get extended in mileage terms but gets consumed much faster, you could say, well, that could mean that we're actually going to have to produce more cars. And also, if ride sharing and all that becomes so much easier, are people going to ride more than they do today when it's really hard to go find your car at some parking lot or whatever? If instead you can just pick one up at the corner anytime you want to move more than a few blocks, you know, people may become more mobile. And so, yes, the car gets used a lot more, but there's a lot more utilization in total. So it's a wide open guess as to whether even the raw volume is impacted favorably or unfavorably by the move to these ride-sharing concepts.
Plus, these autonomous cars are now going to be transportation for all kinds of populations who are homebound or less mobile. You have the elderly who can't really drive anymore. You have disabled people who can't drive. You also have people who maybe can't afford a car, but they can buy a car, ride a la carte, and so they become more mobile. So I agree with you completely. This is a big question. I sort of tend to believe the forecasts that say this is going to be more cars, not less, even though you would think that you might need less.
I haven't seen one that says more, but I've put it this way. The range of decline is everything from Barclays analysts saying 40% decline in global car sales to Boston Consulting Group saying it's like a negligible amount, like, you know, 0.3% or something like that because of all these factors. And I think, first off, I don't really know what the take rate is going to be on people wanting to either loan their cars out or borrow a car all the time. My car isn't making me any money or it isn't giving me any value while we're sitting here. I still don't want anybody in it. I'm sorry, I just don't.
But what about companies that own fleets of cars,
sure,
like Uber, and just, you know, you decide you don't really need your own car, and especially for families who say, you know, for the weekend when we're going up north, we need one kind of car. When I'm going to work in the morning, I need a different kind of car. When mom's picking up the kids from school and taking them to the soccer game, she needs a different kind of car. And so I visualize companies that get into this business. Now, maybe the automakers themselves get into this business, but I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunity for companies to operate cars, large fleets of cars.
And they'll turn over faster, like Steve was saying, that if you're putting three times the mileage on them every year, you're not going to see you're not going to see as many 9-year-old, 10-year-old cars driving around the road because they're just not going to make it. And by the way, look, so I rented a car on vacation last week. It had 55,000 miles on it. That's about as many miles as I want to see on a rental. It was really a piece of junk. It looked like it had been driven through a hailstorm. It was clean and all that, but it was feeling pretty crappy. It squeaks and rattles everywhere. A 55,000-mile rental car or, you know, Uber fleet car or ride-sharing vehicle is going to feel much different than a 55 or 85,000-mile car that you own personally and clean and take care of and have detailed and that sort of thing. So those cars are going to be undesirable for those fleet companies like Uber and Lyft, those fleet companies and rental car companies, much faster than a car. You know, my last Mini I drove until it had over 90,000 miles, and the guy who bought it, he got a great car because I kept that thing pristine. It looked pretty damn new, and a lot of people who like cars or just take care of their stuff do that.
How much did that rental car cost you for the week?
$178.
That's why it had 55,000 miles on it.
No, it was with Alamo, which, by the way, was not a great experience either. But I don't get I've seen more high-mileage rental cars because the point you made early on about the three-month rental car contracts, that's gone. There are some high-rotation rental car contracts between the automakers and the auto rental companies, but we're talking like 12 months now instead of 3 and 6, and sometimes even more than that, sometimes 2 to 3 years they're keeping these cars. They're just not taking on the risk, and the auto companies do not want to put a six-month-old car out in a dealer auction and destroy their own pricing. So they're not doing as much of that stuff as they used to.
Well, back in the day, remember, they were trying to guard their market share. So yes, if they couldn't put these cars somewhere, they had to close plants, and that they didn't want to do.
Yeah, no, that was the key. It became more expensive.
The Japanese car industry was destroying them.
Yep.
Yeah.
When the legacy costs were burdening the Detroit 3, it was cheaper
to
make a car than to not make a car. And so it was just blow it out and give them all to Hertz and Avis and Enterprise.
When you had the jobs bank, you had to pay the workers no matter what. So, and Rick Wagoner said that one time. He said, look, I got to pay these guys whether they build them or not. So all costs being equal, I may as well keep the market share.
And you see what happened to him.
Yeah.
Right.
We got to take another quick break, and I got a lot more things, and we all do, I'm sure, to talk to Steve about. But right now, we got to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back with Steve Miller, Daron Levine, David Welch. Steve, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, boy, it's almost impossible to start a car company these days. And yet we see Tesla sort of doing a good job of the product. I'm not so sure about whether this company can make it or not, but I'm intrigued to hear what your take is on Tesla.
Well, first off, I'm admirous of Tesla because they've come into a business that I thought was, had too many competitors already, and very established, and the cost of developing a car is billions of dollars. But to his credit, he's got the company up and running. I will also say he's had tremendous support from government in terms of giving him subsidies for the factories, subsidies to the buyers for doing it. And you can kind of forgive if somehow all of that leads and permits the development of technology that we really need, which is efficient batteries. Right now, it's a mess. All these little camera batteries wired together in order to do an electric car. And somehow we need the breakthrough where we can get an efficient battery package to both cut the cost, cut the space requirements for it, and also don't consume so much energy just hauling the batteries around. So there's hopefully a bright future for electric cars. And once again, I salute Tesla. They, made it a fashionable thing to do, which helped because there's a lot of, people want to do it because it's the in thing to show your neighbors. But when those subsidies go away, we will find out whether they are for real. I think a more interesting question along this line is, who's going to own the automotive market of the future? Is it going to be Silicon Valley or Detroit?
What do you think?
Beats me. but if you look at the where young people want to go and spend their energies, they are so creative, beyond what old geezers like me can ever think about.
We were creative once too, Steve.
I just see this, the pace of change is going to pick up dramatically here. As I say again, I wish I were young enough to be starting over in the auto business. I think this is going to be just such an exciting sector going forward. People inherently want mobility. And, autos in whatever form they take going forward is what's going to provide it. And we probably can't imagine what it's going to look like, even 20 years from now. Pace of change picking up.
Well, I also want to ask Daron and David, what do you guys think of Tesla's new master secret plan that's not so secret anymore?
You were just working on this, David. You probably have the freshest information.
Freshest info, but not the freshest mind. I was up at 6 for GM's earnings, too. But anyway, no, look, the master plan, I don't think was all that masterful. And the best evidence of that is Tesla shares are off 3-4% today. Now, the stock market reaction, the best gauge of whether or not a plan is masterful. In this case, it is, because the guy's got fans, particularly among investors, who've been throwing money at this company despite the fact that it's burning cash and has no hope of making a profit in the next couple of years, at least, probably longer than that. And the thing really landed with a thud. Now, why is that important as well? Because he's had a lot of bad news the past couple months. He had a crash with his self-driving car technology that's prompted a NHTSA investigation. There are reports, kind of unconfirmed, but possible, that there's an SEC investigation because he didn't disclose certain things before the secondary offering that they did in May. And he's had a high-profile executive leave for Facebook. So Tesla's had an unusual run of bad news, all which drove the stock down significantly. He starts tweeting about the master plan, and he did this over a course of 10 days, which really helped get the stock back up to levels from before he proposed his SolarCity deal, which was received very badly. That shot the stock down 10% in a day. So he more than recovered that loss in the share price because people were getting excited that something big was coming. And as it turns out, it's just this very long-range plan of adding pickup trucks, a compact SUV, a bus, a cargo truck, or a semi, basically, and then weaving into it solar panels on rooftops that can charge all of these different vehicles into this one integrated plan. And what this tells everybody is, okay, he hasn't gotten the Model 3 out yet. He's had problems with the Model X, which was just launched last fall. Now he's talking about this whole new fleet of vehicles, three of which would be built on platforms that it is nothing like what he's making right now. So even the manufacturing base he's got is not capable without really big investments. And even now, very bullish analysts and hedge funds and investment funds that own his shares are starting to say, wait a second.
He reminds me a little bit of a guy. I mean, you used to see these people at the circus where they have plates spinning on sticks and spinning the plates, and they start to wobble, and he's spinning this one and spinning that one. And, okay, so things are bad. So like you say, okay, we're going to make trucks, we're going to make SUVs, we're going to make this, we're going to make that. One of the things I think that probably all of us here appreciate is that boring old companies like GM really know how to make things in large number, in high quality, with things like logistics. They know a lot about that. Now, they have other weaknesses as automakers, but they really know how to manufacture at quality and against government regulations in large number, and have been doing it for a long time. Companies like Tesla, and Tesla specifically, they don't really know how to do that. I mean, he's made 50,000 cars in 1 year. What is that for General Motors? How much production is that for General Motors?
Well, they sell that many pickups, more than that, every month.
That's one factory for one quarter.
Yeah, exactly. So when you talk about going to 500,000, to 1 million, to adding all kinds of other things, you're talking about the complications of dealing with lots of design, a lot of logistics, a lot of suppliers. These things are long lead time items for a reason. They take a long time. So I have a lot of skepticism when I hear more and more and more and more, especially when most of the forecasts haven't really been met yet. I mean, most of the time when he's made some kind of representation about how many and when, he's missed it, and he's been forgiven.
That's right. And The really big question mark for Tesla is the Model 3, and not just if he can put it out on time, but with quality, and how many will it sell? So think about this, he has 400,000 people who've put up $1,000 to get one. I personally know some people who've managed to get two of those, because they might buy the car and then they might sell the $1,000 voucher they have, or chip they have, to, if it's really that hot, take advantage of the arbitrage. Okay. So there's a bunch of those. Elon said the car will be $35,000 or less. Okay. The Model S was supposed to be $49,000. Then it went to $59,000. Now they're reasonably equipped in the 70s and often well over $100,000. A guy who can buy a $70,000 car can usually go $100,000. Okay. You're talking about a guy who shops a 7 Series versus an S Class. That's mostly the same buyer. A guy or woman who buys a $35,000 car
cannot go
often
40.
Cannot go 50. No. Okay, there's a reason BMW sells a lot of 3 Series and not so many 5s. The guy who buys the 3 would love the 5. He can't get it. So if Tesla comes, if Elon pulls another bait and switch, not intentionally fraudulent, but on the pricing like that, where the come on is 35, these people want their $1,000 back. And so he's got a liquidity issue with that if he spends that money.
And think about the competition that's coming as well. I mean, we have the Chevy Bolt coming at the end of the year, which is a really no compromise electric vehicle from General Motors that I.
But also a no style one compared to what Tesla does. It's another hatchback.
Okay,
compact, Americans hate.
Fair enough. The design, let's say, of the Model 3, which we haven't seen yet, but let's say the design of it is better than the Bolt. Still, this is serious competition for the midstream electric car that Tesla's going to have. And then afterwards, we start seeing lots of luxury electric models that are going to be... models that are going to be competition from Audi and from others. They're going to be competition for the Model S and the Model X. So I think he hasn't really had any competition up to now, or not much of it other than Leaf. And let's say some other outliers.
No, he really hasn't had that. Hey, look, we've got a couple of questions here coming in from the audience, Steve. Armin wants to know, or says, most vehicles look the same as their counterparts these days, which seems to be caused by regulation. Do you have any concern that the same will happen with interiors?
No. The exterior's becoming more and more alike because of the basic law of aerodynamics. Once you've decided the package of how many people you're going to have and what space you're going to give them, then you pretty much have to shrink wrap the exterior around that to have an aerodynamic vehicle in order to protect your fuel economy. The inside is just the opposite. It is, I think, getting more and more attention these days as the place where automakers can distinguish one vehicle from another. You know, when you're getting into an interior, into a luxury car, by the interior, not by the exterior so much anymore. I mean, it's very different from when I was a young boy and all the tail fins and everything else were the distinguishing characteristic. Now it's the interior. So I think there's going to still be a lot of differentiation in the interior. And particularly if we move to, you know, self-driving vehicles and so on, the concepts for what the interior should look like and feel like is going to change radically and provide a lot more opportunity.
Totally agree. Also, we've got a phone call here, and I think it's about CAFE. Carmen, let's bring in that phone call.
Yes, this is Clem Zarovsky at Delmont, Pennsylvania. Isn't all this high mileage, the 45.5 or 54.4 miles per gallon, doesn't have anything to do with saving the fuel? It has all to do with saving the planet. Isn't this all about global warming is why they're pushing this? Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, there's a number of things that happen when you consume less fuel. It has an environmental impact. You don't have to go pull as much of that fuel out of the ground. You don't have as much exhaust and carbon dioxide to contend with. So the whole purpose of it is aimed at an environment. In addition, to the extent our country is either a net importer or net exporter of fuel, if you consume less, you're going to have a balance of trade impact as well. So that, to me, is what it's all about. The only question is whether a fuel mandate on manufacturers, which puts them maybe at odds with the customer, is a better way, as I have said, than having a tax on fuel. If you want to cut fuel consumption for all the environmental benefits and economic benefits that go with it, why not just tax it? It's the simplest, quickest, slickest way to get your drivers to prefer cars that consume less fuel. Maybe their driving would change so they're not, you know, jackrabbit starts and so on. It's the easiest way to collect money for government, which, you know, has an endless need for money. So there's a lot of reasons why that should be the mechanism rather than the one we got. But as John would point out, politically, it is death for any politician to advocate taxing fuel. It's just too precious to individual voters. So
it's too easy for the voters to get rid of those people who voted in favor of that. So they would say, if they were here, well, that's easy for you to say, Steve. You're not going to get voted out of office at IAC.
But for all that, Europe has the same need to elect their politicians, and yet they've all got $8 to $10 a gallon for their fuel.
They also have tax on bigger engines, too.
Yeah.
On big displacement, is it anything over 3 liters in a lot of markets?
Depends on the country and all, but yeah.
Basically, big performance, big V6s and V8s get taxed to death. Yeah. So if you're a rich guy and you want your 750, you're just going to pay more, and that keeps everybody buying 320s.
Yeah.
Hey, look, we've burned up an hour. It went by like that for me, certainly, but we're going to have to wrap it up here. Steve Miller, thanks so much for coming in. Very interesting. I love getting the background. I love talking with people who were there, seeing it all firsthand. It's terrific talking with you.
Thank you.
David Welch from Bloomberg.
Great.
Ron Levine from TheStreet.com and your own Sirius. Which channel on Sirius?
Sirius XM, Insight 121, noon on Saturday.
All right. Very good. Well, I want to thank all you guys and, of course, want to thank all of you who tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, feel good about driving.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.